Hey, Roger, for inviting me. Today we're going to talk about meta learning and learned optimizers. This is joint work with Jifu, a very close collaborator. I've been working with him for a few years. I work with him on a daily basis. I'm a visiting scholar at Mila, and Jifu is also a postdoc at Mila. I'm going to talk to you about meta learning and the potential of meta learning, its applications in quantum computing, and I think this is probably one of the most important fields in computer science, and I say that very very honestly. I guess, I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with, meta learning, or is anyone here familiar with meta learning, like at all? Oh, really? Meta learning, like, it's not very, like, most, like, definitions, as you can imagine, don't have a sound definition. But generally speaking, you have our training data is our machine learning problems. And our goal is just to, learn something interesting over these problems. And so, a setup might look something like this. Doesn't have to be like this, but it's generally something like this. So we have, like, different problem instances, and then we feed them into some sort of meta learning algorithm, and it learns something interesting from these problem instances. So in this sort of setup, we have different training data and different architectures, we feed that into a meta learning algorithm, and it produces something cool for us. Hopefully, capturing some sort of information between the problems. This is what a lot of people like to define, meta learning. I like to sometimes define it like this way, but another definition that I think is more appropriate is sort of the idea of learning some sort of mathematical device from example problem instances. It's our job, as as modelers, to supply the meta learning algorithm with the appropriate problem instances such that it can learn the device we want. So what can we learn? What can we learn with meta learning? We can learn an optimizer. We can learn a tailored loss function. We can learn a data generation scheme. We can learn basically anything at this point. And that's what I've learned as I've been working on meta learning for a few years now. Literally anything you can think of, I've found, like, some sort of meta learning application that works. And the interesting thing now, why meta learning now, is that I think we're really at the sort of the inflection point where we're going to see a lot more learned sort of mathematical devices that are going to be proliferated to the public. There's a few companies. I think I'm going to talk about this a bit later, but there's a billion-dollar company called DataRobot. And they provide they do meta learning, and they actually, I think it's the next slide. Yeah, that's the next slide, so I'll talk about it now. What DataRobot does is this problem called algorithm selection. This is probably the most primitive meta learning problem that you can think of. It is given a machine learning problem, predict the machine learning algorithm that will perform the best. Very simple, right? As a normal, modeler or machine learning practitioner, something you probably would do is extract features from each experiment. These are just very, very basic features that you can extract. This problem has been around for decades, so this is just very, very primitive, features. Then you build some sort of, like, regression model or classification model to predict the accuracy of a given algorithm. So you might say, like, the performance of this algorithm will be, like, this is our label, so we're trying to predict this particular value. We're trying to predict which algorithm will run the best without running them. Do you have a question?
Yes. You just started saying that meta learning is like comparing, like you have multiple problems
Yes.
that a machine learning algorithm can solve, and then you compare them to collectively to see what they have in common. That's what you're doing? That's what's the meaning of meta learning? It's like, okay, so like these are the class of problems that this sort of do well for them, but do you like choose in advance what class of problems you're comparing with to see what kind of features you want to extract? Like for example, like definitely if you are working in the field of natural language processing and doing word embedding, the type of optimization and methods that you are using there is very different than image processing and type of like algorithm that do well there, or the type of machine learning algorithm that can give you a better result there.
Mm-hmm.
So like what type, like how do you choose which problems to compare to extract the best mathematical device that would do well for a specific type of problems? I think.
That's a great question. And the answer I think is sort of up to you as the device, how generally you want the device to be. So there's some, you know, papers that try to expose the problem to as many problems as possible because they want to learn for a general purpose device. And so, for example, they learn an optimizer, they expose it to so many different types of optimization problems, and then and hopefully it'll work well on any optimization problem in general. But typically, like if you concentrate the sort of distribution of the tasks in a certain domain, typically it can exploit those task specific traits and then perform better because sort of like the no free lunch theorem. Is still, we're still bound to that. And I guess I have a few slides on literally that topic, yeah. And so, this is sort of the algorithm selection, feature engineering. So it's like they have just a few pages of just, features and stuff, but they know the general problem, predict the algorithm that's going to do the best. And so in meta learning, you can construct a setup where you can learn almost anything. And so this is the sort of classical counterpart that you might use in your, everyday work. And then we could replace that with a learned version of a learned variant, and usually realize some significant increase in performance, either in accuracy or in time. And generally, as I mentioned earlier, usually these performance gains are because it exploits some sort of problem specific characteristics of the domain that you are of the problems you've exposed the device to. So for example, you can learn a really good distance metric, for example, by just exposing it to a bunch of different like k-means clustering problems, and then you take that distance metric and you give it to someone else, and then they can cluster things really, really well. And so I'll go through most of these and then we'll compare them, and then we'll talk about learned optimizers in a bit more detail. And so the behavior of the device is sort of governed by the input problems that you supplied, and as well as the meta loss, which I'll talk a bit later about. And ideally, what will happen is that the learned device will capture commonalities between the input problems you supplied. And typically in meta learning, we hope that the device is going to work on similar problems of the same nature that you've trained the device on. So you don't really expect it to work on problems that it's never seen before. If you're training like some sort of distance metric specific to like text, you don't really want it to perform on images, right? Like it won't really work that well. I guess the more diverse the distribution of input problems you supply, the more we learn some sort of general purpose device that will work on any type of problem. So sort of the classic example is like people who are trying to learn neural network optimizers that work on all neural networks. Or some people just try to learn optimizers that work on you know, only GANs on only this data set, only this, you know, type of architecture. So it, you know, it's up to you to decide what how generally you want your device to be. And sort of the, and again, the training data dictates how well the device will perform. So you have to sort of give some good training examples or, you know, it won't work that well. And so we'll go through a short survey, talk about learned optimizers, and then we'll talk about machine learning and quantum computing. And so there's actually a lot of machine learning algorithms, but I'm going to focus on stuff that are actually sort of practically useful. So either they give sort of less compute, less data, or higher accuracy. So I guess we're all familiar with sort of the paradigm of fine-tuning. This is a very, you know, common, arguably, meta learning framework. And I guess one limitation of this approach is that you cannot fine-tune a music model to solve a text classification problem, right? That, how do you do that, right? It doesn't work. Another problem is that you cannot perform dual fine-tuning. Like if you have two set of weights, I want to simultaneously tune sort of the target problem with both of them. How do I do that, right? So that doesn't sort of work. This is just a comment. Like I think some people say that classical fine-tuning is not meta learning, but I think it is. And I'll get to the MAML algorithm a bit later. In the fine-tuning paradigm, we learn some sort of representation, and we that is the device of interest that we give to other people. So considering these two limitations, what is considered a good meta learning framework? I just came up with some traits I thought were good. One is that we can have multiple input problems, so we can sort of, fine-tune simultaneously with multiple problems at once. We don't want to just, fine-tune with one set of weights. We want to fine-tune with 1,000. It would be cool if we had millions of weights, and we can simultaneously, fine-tune with all of them into the target problem. That would be pretty interesting. Another thing would be we can transfer a lot of information from these problems. So ideally we can sort of squeeze out, all the priors from those problems and inject them into the new problem. So that is sort of the phenomenon of transfer efficiency. In the worst case, this will actually have negative transfer. So we all sort of want to avoid that, where we actually do worse by injecting these priors. Another one that's really interesting is sort of, I mentioned earlier, can different problem structure. So if you have, as I mentioned earlier, if you have some set of weights, how do you fine tune a music model with a text classification problem? You can't do that. So you need some sort of way to have heterogeneous problem structures. Another thing is that when we have our device, another thing that people like to see it do is sort of generalize to out-of-task distribution. So even though we sort of supplied some sort of set of problem instances, can it, still work on at least reasonably outside of the domain? It doesn't have to be totally out of the domain, but somewhat outside of it. Ideally, we could use less training data on the target problem. In the fine tuning paradigm where we have these representation, it'll take so much less data to learn some sort of the same model. So we're saving data on the target problem to learn sort of the same model. Computationally efficient during meta training, so building the device is not very expensive, and computationally efficient when exposed to a query problem. And these sort of make sense to me. And so I guess the first one we'll talk about is learning sort of a distance metric. And the goal is to learn a distance metric that others can use so they can plug into their metric-based classifiers. So something like k-means classifier or a nearest neighbors classifier. And this metric will sort of encode some sort of notion of similarity and sort of group things together appropriately. Maybe if we exposed it to a lot of different genomic problems. It can learn some sort of genomic similarity metric, and then they can plug it in, our users can plug it into their sort of setup, and then they can benefit from it on their genomic problems.
So just a philosophical question. Doesn't this make explainability worse in general?
Explainability in terms of like the...
Well, if you have a distance metric that you understand, you know, and you're replacing it with something that's learned.
That's true.
If you sort of think about that in every context that you talk about, doesn't that just kind of like screw up the explainability of what you're doing?
Explainability.
I don't know how to define explainability.
Interesting. I mean, like that could be the very much the case. You have to like profile the learned metric or the learned device exhaustively to see the behavior of it. And then you're gonna have to perform like standard, you know, model analysis techniques where they like in finance where they stress test the model. That's what I can think of. Or you can reverse engineer the model to see, you know, what's learning, you know, use influence functions if anyone's familiar with that, or you know, visualize their feature maps. You know, there's a lot of
stuff. Another question. You said the modern meta learning era, was there some definitive start to that?
Yeah, I think around when it really took off was around, you know, 2016 to 2017. When like the MAML and learning to learn with LSTMs sort of took off, I think that was sort of where I saw, you know, there's a huge rise in, you know, meta learning papers. Before that, I don't think many people really cared about the problem. I mean, they did. Like, there was a lot of work in like lifelong learning and different stuff. But like, yeah, go ahead.
Are you done with that answer?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool. So I have two questions. First, what's the difference between this and like a transfer learning? Like in a transfer learning, you seem to be doing the same thing. You can kind of like have a very general question. You train your network on that, train that, and then you use that as a base for training all the other models. You just need to modify it a little bit. Mm-hmm. It very much sounds like that to me first. And also about your metric, it again, like it's a very general, not coarse grained metric. It's like a general one that's supposed to be suitable for a specific class of questions that you have designed as the superior distance metric. So for any specific question, you still need to do some fine tuning. So starting, you're saying that like if one starts from this superior distance metrics for like genomic problems, then doing that fine tuning is less expensive than starting from scratch to find such a metric for that specific problem.
I see. So the first question. So for transfer learning, like it's a lot of people see meta learning and transfer learning to be simultaneous. And some people think that you can learn a meta learning device to perform transfer learning. So I've seen both definitions, and at this point, it's really hard to say what the real definition is. But I think both of those are, you know, both are very valid definitions. I guess for the second one, so you're saying you need to fine tune the distance metric further on a target problem.
Like either you just create that superior distance metric based on a very general rules that genomic problems like a distance between genes and they follow, and you say that so instead of starting from scratch, I start from this matrix, and I for each problem that I want to apply this to, then I can improve upon that.
Yes.
To find the final answer.
Yes.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very, I guess this one is, yeah, again, domain specific to sort of a particular domain being genomics. It's going to see all these genomic problems, and it's going to, you know, learn some sort of interesting similarity metric or distance metric captured between those problems. I guess once you learn this, you can plug it into a distance-based classifier or a clustering technique. It looks something like this, like in pseudocode. One implementation is through prototypical networks. And I'll just give you the pseudocode of that setup. So this is sort of just a reminder of the setup where we have these different problems. Maybe look something like this, and we plug it into some sort of classifier. And we want our meta learning algorithm to learn some sort of distance metric that works with all these different types of distance-based problems. First of all, we start with a random distance metric. So we parameterize it with something. We start off with some random distance metric, and then we plug it into some sort of our nearest neighbor's classifier or some sort of distance-based classifier, and then we make predictions based on the test features. We train it first, and then we make predictions on the test features. And so, if our metric is good, these predictions should also be good. So in general, what we're going to do is just backpropagate through this entire process. That's why we use the softmax function. So we're going to make this sort of entirely differentiable, and then backpropagate through the entire thing into the learned metric, and then update it. So yeah, it looks something like this. And then we compute the sort of loss between the predicted and test labels. And if our distance metric is any good, it should, you know, we should get a, you know, decent loss. And so then we backpropagate that loss with respect to the learned metric. And then we update the learned metric accordingly to the gradients. And this is generally the general framework for sort of the prototypical networks setup. The general idea is that we just make the entire thing backpropagable and backpropagate through into the learned metric. And so now the question is, you know, how do we parameterize the learned metric? And in the original paper, it looks something like this. So you take the Euclidean distance. First, you put the input vectors into sort of a hidden layer, and then you compute the Euclidean distance between them. So it's something like this, and the priors are encoded in the hidden layer of the learned metric. And I guess you can parameterize it, you know, however you want. This is just sort of the general framework. And in the original paper, they sort of introduced this paradigm for specifically the application of few-shot learning. But in my opinion, you can sort of generalize this to any sort of setup you want. And we'll sort of go into this a bit more in detail in the next few slides on how you can customize a meta-learning device to do what you want using the meta-loss function. We'll get into that a bit later. And again, we're sort of just backpropagating through the distance-based procedure into sort of the parameterized metric. And okay, so now onto the topic of sort of learned optimizers, and it follows a very similar setup, by the way. And in this setup, we try to learn some sort of regression model. In regression, we're trying to predict some sort of continuous value. And in the general setup is that we're given some gradients of the loss landscape as a feature vector, and we're trying to predict the delta update. There's variants to this type of setup, but this is, in my opinion, the most easiest to understand. Hopefully the learned optimizer will be able to navigate the loss landscape. So we're exposing it to all these different problems. It sees all these different gradients of these example problems. And then when we take this optimizer and we put it onto a new problem, it should be able to just walk around and go to the global optimum in like 10 seconds, right? So it can navigate the loss landscape quicker of a new problem. I can find higher quality local optima compared to a vanilla algorithm, you know, like Atom. Let's get into what it looks like. And this was proposed by Yoshua and his brother, Yoshua Benjo from Montreal. So here again, we start with a learned optimizer, and we can parameterize it however we want, a random, you know, function. Taking in the gradients or whatever you want as input, and you're going to produce the delta update as the output. And then right here, we just run the optimizer normally. We just run it. We just like this is just literally you can just like even ignore this part, this learned optimized part, and just pretend it's Atom. And this is just, you know, just testing it out. Let's see how this works. And then depending on how it went, we will move the optimizer parameters around. So if it went, like if we got a good loss at the end and it went really well, like, oh, let's continue doing that, right? And so we compute the meta gradients based on the last loss. At least you can do it sort of whatever you want, like in terms of the meta gradient, but like in this setup, we will use the last loss as the meta loss. So yeah, if it went well, we got a good loss at the end, we'll continue going that way. If we didn't, we'll fix it. And then, so we get the gradients and we update it. And then so you just apply this, you know, algorithm over and over and over again, and you'll converge to a good learned optimizer, right? And that's basically it. It's not very complicated. This is the unrolled optimization procedure. This is how, honestly, most meta learning algorithms work out. Like you just, you parameterize a device, test it out, observe the behavior, update the device. That's literally most of meta learning today. The issue here, like, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but when you do this step right here, you're essentially just building a massive computational graph, right? Because it's just chaining over and over again. And then you have to backpropagate through that graph. You're computing the Hessian, right, at that point. And so you're computing Hessian over a very, very long optimization trajectory, which is you know, not particularly computationally effective. It becomes very slow. And I guess another cool thing is that you can run multiple updates in parallel. So like if you had 20 different problems, you can run this exact same setup like 20 different times and average the gradients and compute the meta gradient update. That's true for, again, most meta learning frameworks. The cool thing about this paradigm is you can perform this concept of multi-source fine tuning. As I mentioned earlier, like you, with normal fine tuning, you cannot fine tune with like seven different models, right? Like it'd be really cool if you could, you know, have this massive repository of zillions and zillions of models, and you have a target problem and just go, like fine tune, like transfer everything there, and fine tune all that interesting information into the target model. But you can't do that with normal fine tuning. So the interesting thing about learned optimizers we found is that you can form this concept of a multi-source fine tuning, which is honestly a cool way of, you know, saying I just think it's kind of cool, to be honest. But yes, it's capable of performing this concept of multi-source fine tuning, where you have multiple problems of different characteristics. This allows us to solve the problem that we saw before of fine-tuning a music model with a text classification problem. And it also allows us to do it with multiple problems. So you can fine-tune a text classification problem with a music model, a genomics model, like seven different models that are totally unrelated. That works pretty well. And normal fine-tuning only works with one problem during fine-tuning. So it's not particularly effective. So I guess another thing that I mentioned earlier is that you want to craft your meta loss to encourage the desired behavior of the device. Very, very important. So for example, like if we want to build a learned optimizer that finds models that are defensible to adversarial examples, how would we do this? So actually it's very simple. It's only one line change to what we saw before. So we have our learned optimizer, we run it again. The only thing we change is we have this meta loss that just computes a loss over these adversarial features and adversarial labels. These are just like an adversarial set. That we have at our disposal. And the cool thing about this, I think, is that the optimizer has no access to this information. We're judging it, we're saying this is how we're assessing you, but you have no understanding of what an adversarial, you don't have access to this data set, but you're still expected to perform under these measures. So you can think how powerful this is. Like you can design an optimizer to do, you know, whatever you want. To exhibit any behavior that you want, to explore the loss landscape, to find certain models that you find attractive. whether it's being hyper robust to noise or, you know, what have you. I think it's pretty cool.
Have you actually done this against adversarial examples? Have you actually built a model to be robust against adversarial examples?
Yeah, I think it was a paper by DeepMind some time ago. It was like learned optimizers that are robust to input noise. And it was sort of a similar setup. It wasn't exactly adversarial examples, but it was very similar setup. I think they did mention, they tried on different types of noise. And this was exactly the setup they used. This is just, you know, an example I came up with. I don't know if you guys saw a pattern here, but we can use the sort of following setup for sort of a guidepost for developing modeling algorithms. And this is, framework that's been around for decades. It's just bi-level optimization. We have, I'll show you. We have, of course, we parameterize some mathematical device of interest, whether it's an optimizer or a metric. We observe the performance of that metric on a new problem. And then we compute the gradient of the mathematical device's parameters with respect to the performance. That's it.
So you keep saying device, but what is the device?
Yeah, that's a good point. The device is just the object we're trying to learn. Maybe I should use a different word, but.
So I think suppose you want to learn an optimizer. You say you want to learn an optimizer.
Yeah.
So there must be a mathematical expression for that.
There is.
Okay. And so all you're trying to do is learn the parameters associated with that mathematical expression.
Yes.
That fit the problem.
Yes. Yeah, so the optimizer is just a neural network that it could be like a multi-layer perceptron that takes in the gradient or even one gradient, right? Like it just takes a single gradient and it predicts the delta update. So maybe like a single layer, multi-layer perceptron. So that's the thing we're trying to update, that multi-layer perceptron. And here's, another example is the phenomenon of learning loss functions. A loss function is here to tell us how well a model's doing. A domain-specific loss metric that we might be interested in is properly penalizing an example like this, where you have like predicted dogs and actual wolf. This should be not penalized that much, whereas a normal classifier normal loss metric will penalize this pretty aggressively. So if you can learn some sort of domain-specific loss function, that would be pretty cool. So an ML engineer would have to manually encode this information without meta learning. That might take some time. And another thing we could do with this is, and I see this is probably the main application, is that we could give this to people and they could train their models with this loss function. And this is capable of learning problem-specific regularization strategies within the loss function. I guess our somewhat recent approach for learning loss functions is just a similar framework where we we parameterize the loss function, then we compute the derivatives of the loss function, and that's basically it. It's very simple. I don't think we have to go through it. This is proposed by Facebook some time ago. It was actually, I think, rejected at a iClear. It's sort of a similar framework where you just run we parameterize the loss, and then we observe the performance of it, and then we update the parameters of the loss. And this is the exact framework they proposed. And another framework was proposed by OpenAI was instead of resorting to the solving the outer problem using gradient-based search, you can use any optimization strategy that you want. You can use what they proposed for loss search was using evolution strategies, the outer problem. And that made sense for them because they were working, the inner problem was so hard to sort of compute gradients through. And it was just, it was, so they had to resort to some gradient-free method, like evolution strategies. That's basically it. I guess another framework is the phenomenon of learned initializations, but I guess it's the most famous paradigm today, which is the MAML family. And so I guess the it's very similar to fine-tuning, except we wrap it around we essentially expand it for multi-source training. So we want it to work on several different problems instead of just one problem. Ideally, on all those problems, it'll learn a common set of weights that work well across all those problems, such that someone else can fine-tune them and create a great model out of that. Does that make sense, everyone?
So is that like the question of transfer learning? Is that the idea is that you transfer most of the weights over, but there's still a little bit of training that goes on?
Yeah. So it's you're learning the you're doing representational transfer. You're giving some initial weights to someone else. But the idea is that instead of just training on one model, you're training on like seven or eight or how many other models you want. And then you're learning some sort of common initial weights between all those problems. If you do it for one problem, it can overfit.
And that holds across different architectures?
No, it's only holds across one. So this is actually not capable of performing heterogeneous transfer learning. So that's where you have different model parameter sizes. So it's not capable of doing this, whereas learned optimizers is, and learned loss functions is. I guess I'll talk about this a bit more later. This is not capable of transferring to different architectures. But it's sort of
the input and output dimension for this has to be the same.
Yeah, it does. Yes, be the same. Yeah. But that has some advantages that we'll see later. To do heterogeneous transfer, you typically had to make a lot of assumptions, and those assumptions just like sort of kill transfer efficiency by a lot. Whereas this has like almost full transfer efficiency. So you want to train. We want to build some sort of pre-trained weights over several data sets and then give it to someone and they can, use them. They can benefit from it. And then I guess the interesting comment is that there's the companies that sell pre-trained weights as a service. And some of them use meta learning to
learn. What's a set of pre-trained weights worth?
Yes, they charge for like training hours, and I guess they also charge for prediction, each prediction you make. And usually, in a lot of cases, they don't even give you the model. Good business, I guess. The MAML, this is generally called MAML, and it's really exactly the same. And this is like, I guess the disappointing thing about meta learning, that it's a lot of it's just bi-level optimization, where it's what I mentioned before, this is how it works at least today. A lot of the algorithms work. You parameterize the device, and then you compute the meta gradients through that device. An interesting thing about this setup, again, similar to the learned optimizer setup, is that you have this. You're running an inner loop here, so you're constructing a large computational graph, and then you compute the Hessian over that graph, so you're computing the derivative of a derivative, derivatives, and that's not the most computationally efficient thing. And so there's approximations to this, but this is the general framework. And again, this is just one update step. So you can run this, however many times you want until convergence. And so I guess there's some similarities between MAML and learned optimizers. They're very similar. I'm not sure if you guys have implemented stuff like this, but like you know, it's almost like one line of code like change, like it's almost nothing. So in MAML, the metaparameters are the initial weights, and learned optimizers, the metaparameters are the weights of the optimizer. And the training algorithm is sort of the same. You do unrolled optimization. There's an inner loop, and then you backpropagate through that inner loop. There's a sort of terminology here where they say this is an optimization-based meta learning method because there's a sort of optimization loop inside the meta learning algorithm. And I used to think that learned optimizers were superior to MAML because learned optimizers can learn to pre-train the optimizee. It just needs to hop to the initial weights at the first iteration, and they can, you know, do the rest. I guess this was sort of proved by Chelsea Finn that this is a learned initialization paired with vanilla SGD can approximate any learned optimizer. She's just saying that MAML can approximate any optimizer under the right conditions. So yeah, it's very, very similar framework.
You can have MAML as a first step and then have a learned optimizer after,
right? Yeah, people do that, yeah. I think it was someone from ELA who did that, yeah. Hugo La Rochelle. And I guess another meta learned framework, this is a bit different, but I thought this was really interesting, is the phenomenon of a meta learned sampler. But typically the goal here is that you want to sample from some target distribution that's potentially totally intractable. So one approach is you have like some sort of fixed number of samples that approximates the target distribution. And basically what happens is you want to move those samples until they accurately approximate the target distribution. So this is a technique in Bayesian deep learning that I thought was really, really interesting. And in general, there's a lot of literature around neural samplers that are very, very interesting. I don't think they're very popular, but I think it was worth mentioning. So in general, the algorithm sort of looks like this. You initialize the samples randomly. You have a loss that is the loss of the distribution from the samples and the actual distribution. And then you compute the Stein variational gradient to move the samples such that you're sort of moving them to sort of match the actual target distribution. And then you run this long enough, you just keep moving the samples until they approximate the target distribution. So this is great. This is a great, interesting framework, but the issue is that this step right here is pretty computationally expensive. So what they proposed in this paper was to construct a neural sampler, which literally all it does is just a neural network that tries to mimic this step. A neural network that just literally tries to copy computing this gradient right here. So that's literally all they do. So they just use that sort of gradient as a supervision signal, and they train sort of a neural sampler to sort of mimic the behavior of that sampling procedure. I guess this is they mentioned in the paper that this is sort of a form of meta learning, because if you have this really good sampler, you give it to other people, and then they don't have to run that many, you know, they don't have to use that much compute to do probabilistic inference. This is interesting. I like this one because it's sort of different. I guess you just keep on exposing this neural optimizer to as many problems as possible, and it should save you a lot of compute. Another sort of paradigm I think a lot of people are familiar with is sort of the phenomenon of learnable hyperparameter search, where in general you have the setup where you have a sort of a distribution over hyperparameters, and you want to, you know, pick the next distribution intelligently and to define the best hyperparameter combination. So it's sort of this reinforcement learning problem where you're just constantly exploring this this hyperparameter space. And so you can do this, you can solve this using Gaussian processes as the sort of prior for the model distribution, or sorry, the hyperparameter distribution. And what they sort of propose in this paper is to you leverage a sort of a database of existing hyperparameter runs, each with a Gaussian process. And then they have just a clever way of combining them. There's just a formulaic approach, non-learnable approach, where they just combine all the Gaussian processes that you have in this existing database of hyperparameter runs. And they use this, I guess, successfully at Facebook. And I guess the another thing was there's recently a paper on learning acquisition functions to sort of explore the hyperparameter space. So you're picking out new hyperparameters to try next to explore that space. Another recent paper, I think this was just like a few weeks ago, actually, they proposed a paper where they have just a reinforcement learning agent that intelligently explores that hyperparameter space. So there's two ways you could sort of do this here. You can either, you have an existing database of hyperparameter runs, and then you can sort of combine all those runs intelligently to help inform new runs using the Gaussian processes. Or you can learn sort of an acquisition function using RL. Someone from ELA was sort of big on this, and I'm not sure I sort of agree, but he says that hyperparameter schemes like NEAT, I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with NEAT. Oh, NEAT. So NEAT is like was a very classic algorithm for evolving neural network architectures. It was a very very interesting method, but it was not very useful. It evolved like this huge like repository of all these neural networks, and just constantly evolve them using the genetic algorithm. He argued that NEAT is not meta learning, but he also said that a setup like this is not meta learning. He also said that neural architecture search is not meta learning. He also said Bayesian hyperparameter optimization is not meta learning. And so I sort of disagree with him here. And again, this is where the definitions break down, and I'm not sure it really matters that much. In my opinion, this is sort of meta learning, because you're learning over example problems or example runs, and you're extracting some sort of common correlations between them. The reason he said it wasn't meta learning was that he wanted some sort of a notion of he wanted a very specific setup, which was every single problem instance has to have a training data set and a test set. And you have to have that for every single problem setup. But I sort of disagree with them here. And whether you agree with it or not, you can pick. I guess this is just a sort of comparison. I do most of my work in learned optimizers. So I made a little bit on learned initializations too. You might want to take this as a sort of a grain of salt. This is sort of the general what I think of them, and this is what the frameworks provide. I guess the big one for me is this phenomenon of heterogeneous transfer. Can you transfer between problems that are different in structure? Learned optimizers can do it. Learned initializations, as we talked about, can't do it. Learned samplers, at least the one that they propose in this paper, cannot do it. Learned hyperparameter search can do it. This one is a sort of controversial, this notion of out of task generalization, we don't even have like regular machine learning algorithms that can do extrapolation. How do we expect, meta-learning algorithms to do it? In this paper, in these two sort of literature communities, they reported know, good transfer outside the domain, at least like reasonably outside the domain, not like, you know, absurd, like very far away from the domain. And I guess in learned optimizers, usually it's not that great. Usually you have to, if you want a learned optimizer to perform really well on a target problem, you have to really supply as many problems as possible during meta training time. Yeah, and I guess I added multi-source just for, I guess, you know, educational purposes, but like every meta learning algorithm in general has supports multi-source training. Whether they're heterogeneous or not is sort of a different topic, but all meta learning frameworks support multi-source training, except for fine tuning. But that's, you know, that's the pre-meta learning paradigm. And I guess these other dimensions, which are transfer efficiency. All of them are good except for learned optimizers because it makes a lot of assumptions. The learned optimizers makes a lot of assumptions. So it's not particularly great at transferring all the knowledge that you have in these input problems on your target problem. And we'll see the assumptions a little later. And let's see. Yeah, I think those are the big ones. All the other ones sort of make sense. And I guess, you know, the big key takeaway here is that you can sort of learn anything. You just need to parameterize it, you know, properly. Parameterize it properly, sort of try to formulate it in a bi-level optimization framework. And you can learn anything, right? You can learn I've seen someone write a paper on meta learning when to stop an iterative procedure. So you don't, you know, waste, you know, a long time, you know, waiting for stuff to happen. Meta learning what data points are more supportive to learn from. Meta learn a model that's robust to adversarial examples that we saw. Meta learn how to correct a drift in your model. And so, yeah, I guess the general idea is that meta learning is here to replace some of the tasks that algorithm designers and mathematicians sort of do. I guess most of you guys are like grad students or postdocs. And really, like most meta learning papers, if you look on, you know, the source code of even like DeepMind or any of these companies, it's usually only like 10 to 30 lines of code. So I would, you know, just try it out. Like, why not? It's not hard. At least the vanilla formulations of the problem, or the vanilla formulations that we saw before. So you can just, you know, play around, see what you know you get. Maybe you can learn something interesting, learn a new device and give it to people, open source it. I don't know, like that would be really cool. What can we learn? In sort of like the worst case scenario, we have to use some sort of classical program induction technique. We have to just like search over the space of all programs, which is probably not the thing we want to do. Like some people have done that. That's been done a lot in the early literature, where you want to learn the device and you just use like symbolic search, like to learn the device.
But you know, the structure of this device that you're referring to, initially you say I initialize it as a random function.
Yep.
What does that mean?
So you initialize it to a random function. So it depends on how you want to parameterize your device. So
all I'm saying is that most likely what you're doing is you're zeroing in on a particular symbolic representation.
Like, yep.
Some linear function.
Yeah.
You have some weights, and then you're finding those weights.
Yeah.
What's different here with what they are talking about, they're doing symbolic search over different symbolic representations with optimization. So you're probably trying to solve a more general problem. So to say that you're initializing using a random function, I mean, I don't think that's precise.
That's fair. You're initializing.
When you say parameterize properly, what you mean is you select an appropriate symbolic representation and then you say which of those, what part of it is other parameters.
I see. An existing frameworks that I talked before, all of them are neural networks. I think you raise a good point. Like you're always searching across some sort of representation space, always. And this one in particular is just, you know, very open-ended. That's the only difference. In this particular one, you know, you're learning here through some sort of know, symbolic search through optimization sort of rule space, which is, you know, again, you know, a space, even though it's extremely open. Other frameworks, you know, learn programs, which is still, you know, representation space. You're learning, you're searching through the space of all programs, which is more expressive than a neural network. So I guess, you know, in the worst case, we have to use some very general program induction technique where we have to search over a very generic space of problems, typically using some sort of symbols. So I guess you want to think, so we have some sort of algorithm that does have some particular function. Can we learn some domain-specific version of that algorithm, not a vanilla version that works on the uniform distribution of all problems in the universe? So we want to concentrate the distribution of the object that we're learning on a particular distribution of functions. And if we do that properly, it'll, you know, exploit problem-specific characteristics within the object that we're trying to learn. And so, you know, for example, like we have a traveling salesman problem solver that really works well on, you know, sort of railroad type style problems. And it sort of learns these problem level heuristics that works really, really well on sort of railroad style problems. And I guess in the learn optimizer sort of paradigm, what this looks like is that if we train it, expose it to solely neural networks, maybe you'll learn something that, you know, this phenomenon of flat valleys leading to higher quality local optima. You know, neural networks are still, you know, an optimization or a problem class, and we can sort of exploit certain unique properties of them. So they're still a problem class, but they're a very large problem class. I guess the core idea is that we're just trying to exploit problem-specific versions of our original sort of vanilla replacements. I sort of alluded to this earlier. Sometimes there's usually a trade-off between these sort of three characteristics. This sort of relates to sort of the no-free lunch theorem, you know, how you know specific, how general should our object that we learn be? What input problems should we support? You know, the accuracy of this device, computational resources used by this device while it's, you know, being used. So usually there's some sort of tension between these sort of parameters. For example, like you could have a learned optimizer that is really massive, right? And it'll do, you know, really well, but, you know, the computational resource is just not, you know, feasible. So there's some tension here between all these things, and you want to, you know, find the right trade-off for your particular application. Yeah.
Talking about the computational resources that you use for doing this learning to impact your device.
Yeah.
So in the few, you had two tables, you were comparing different methods.
Yeah.
There were like in the first table you had the meta learning and hyperparameter learning that were almost comparable in different aspects that you were comparing the different methods with. So I was wondering if you know, like between the meta learning and the hyperparameter learning, which one was which one of them is more efficient or like use less computational resource? Because I know that like a hyperparameter with optimization is like very expensive. So I was wondering if you know, like comparing these two methods, because they were the only two that actually one was good, one was great in the first table that you had. So I was wondering if you know resource wise, which one is less expensive, so more suitable to work with.
During meta testing? Or meta training? During meta training or meta testing?
During meta training.
During meta training, I think the learned hyperparameter search is much better.
Hyperparameter is better.
During meta training, I think so.
Okay. And then meta testing is different?
I think it depends on because if you have a learned optimizer, it does free up some of the hyperparameters you have to tune, because it implicitly learns the learning rate and all this stuff. And I guess another thing is that the hyperparameter search algorithms pick a model family, whereas the sort of learned optimizer or MIML frameworks have more fine-grained control over the model, right? So it can pick directly the model itself. So you don't have to go through this other step.
Okay, so you're saying that even though it is more expensive, but it is at the end more
I think,
model.
Yeah, in general, yeah. Yeah, I think in meta testing it works out, yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, I guess I sort of talked about this earlier. Like in sort of this phenomenon, like, and you read some of the meta learning papers, that they sort of complain that we learn this optimizer, we learn this rule, and like for whatever reason it doesn't work on these other totally arbitrary problems. And maybe the real question is is this reasonable to ask? Where when we have troubles doing extrapolation in regular machine learning. Is it really realistic to learn sort of these universe rules in meta learning? And especially in a lot of these papers where they just have the input problems are not even that big. And sometimes they complain that that we didn't learn universal rules. So this is something just to think about. I guess when you have like a vanilla algorithm or vanilla object or vanilla device, it's supposed to do well at all input cases. Generally speaking, on average, it should do well in all input cases. And so the idea of meta learning is that our device is only supposed to do well on like a certain distribution of problems, and it's not expected to do really well on other outside the domain. And that's where meta learning algorithms usually shine. And so we should exploit this. We're never going to see these certain optimization problems, well, we shouldn't, why are we taking a performance hit from them? And I guess, there's these implicit regularization strategies in SGD, but in my opinion, it's still pretty vanilla, very, very general algorithm. We should probably resort to something like a learned optimizer to exploit, correlations in loss landscape space. I guess I'll just talk about more learned optimizers and some of the promises there. The general setup is that we have some model, right? Like this is a standard supervised learning setup, as you can imagine, just a regression model. It's not a crazy model. It's just a given the gradients as a feature vector, you want to predict a single scalar output. You can imagine here, I took this from this guy from UC Berkeley who wrote the learning optimizer reinforcement learning paper some time ago. And so instead of gradient descent, we're using a learned optimizer. And usually this is parameterized by a neural network. That's how you usually parameterize it today. And I guess I'll just talk about motivation of learned optimizers, why it's has some sort of promise, at least to the literature, some recent trends. And we'll talk about just some of the applications in quantum. This is really interesting. So like we've mentioned before, like our optimizer is exposed to all these loss landscapes. And when it sees a new problem, a new loss landscape, could we find it, ideally in minutes as opposed to weeks? That'd be pretty cool. Provided that we've seen, similar loss landscape at training time, we could tell pretty quickly at test time. And so, learned optimizers are very interesting because this optimization is everywhere. I'm sure you guys use optimization in your research. If you just swap your optimizer out with a learned optimizer, it should capture the correlations between all those problems. And then this learned optimizer you have will able to solve a new problem much, much quicker. So it's a very, you know, general framework that I think is very applicable to everyone's, you know, research here. I sort of talked to this before. Opposed to picking sort of the model family, we have very fine-grained control for the model parameters, which is interesting. So like algorithm selection Bayesian hyperparameter search just sort of pick the model class. They don't pick the weights directly. So we have this very fine-grained control. And so ideally, this fine-grained control allows us to get higher accuracy and faster convergence. We sort of talked about this before. Fine-tuning only works on homogeneous problems, and so we want to fine-tune with different problems, a music model with a text classification problem. And yeah, by encoding the meta loss properly, you're implicitly sort of reshaping the loss landscape, because your optimizer is favoring certain parts of the loss landscape differently than it normally would. So implicitly you're sort of almost reshaping it. Reshaping the loss landscape by encoding the meta loss properly, because again, it'll favor certain parts of that loss landscape more favorably than it usually would. So for example, like you could reshape the loss landscape such that it'll favor certain parts that are more robust to noise if you encode that in the meta loss function. So as we saw before in that adversarial example, we just need to change the meta loss such that it does well on a set that we have in advance. And this was published by Google Brain, and they reported good results pretty recently, a few months ago, on this exact setup. You can form few shot learning, so you're saying you could tell the optimizer that you only have maybe only like three examples, but I still expect you to perform really well on this test set on the meta loss, right? You're still expect to perform extremely well even though you only have these few examples. So you can do that. So it's a very open framework where you can encode the behavior of the optimizer that you want in the meta loss. So I think that's really cool, and it removes sort of annoying hyperparameters such as a learning rate. And I guess anyone familiar with learned optimizers? Anyone familiar with learned optimizers? Okay. So I guess one question that usually comes up, and this is the core assumption that I think that the learned optimizer framework makes that allows it to transfer between very different problems. So you can have like a, again, I keep on saying this, the text classification problem that transfers to a music problem. And some people think that this is really lame, this sort of simplification, but it works well in practice. Reasonably well. So the question that comes up a lot is like you have a gradient, it's taking in the gradients, right? And the gradient has a size of k, where k is the number of parameters in the network. So it's a fixed length vector, right? How do you apply it to a different problem? That doesn't make much sense, right? So you make this sort of component-wise assumption or coordinate-wise assumption. And so each parameter gets its own learned optimizer. So to literally each coordinate, if you have a million parameters in your neural network, you have a learned optimizer for each coordinate. But all the weights are still shared between all the learned optimizers, sort of like a CNN, where the conv layers are still shared. The weights are shared between, they're all the same. So in new backdrop, you're only updating one set of parameters, but they all use, every single parameter uses the same learned optimizer. That makes sense, everyone. So like, each parameter for example, an MLP with 100 parameters, each parameter will be fed into a multilayer perceptron with one input. So it has one input and it's predicting one output, and you just do that same learned optimizer for every single of those 100 parameters. You just apply it 100 times, and then you get the output. And then you compute you observe the behavior, compute the meta gradients, you update it, and that's how they do it in at least 90% of the learned optimizer papers, that's how it's capable of forming heterogeneous transfer, because it's only taking one input, right? at least in this very simplified setup, it's only taking one input, which is the parameter or the gradient, and it's predicting the delta. So you can just take that and plug it into any other classifier, any other model, and it should work well. But this is a sort of breaks down, right? Like it doesn't, because you have a learned optimizer for every single parameter. How do these parameters communicate with each other? There is no notion of communication between the parameters. So that's a key problem in the sort of literature that I guess not many people have addressed at this point. Because you have an optimizer for each single parameter, and each parameter predicts the delta, and they're all independent, right? How are they going to communicate with each other? So that's a key problem with this approach, and that's why the transfer efficiency is generally considered to be low, because there's no interparameter correlation, whereas a scheme like MAML does have interparameter correlation. So each parameter has no idea of its role in the overall optimization procedure. That's what's sort of keep missing in this assumption. And this is also sometimes referred to as a corner-wise assumption. And how do you parameterize the optimizer? Typically, you see like recurrent neural networks as the optimizer. And then recently, we've been seeing MLPs being used as the optimizer. So, yeah.
There's only one input.
So it learns the history of the inputs.
Oh.
So as it sees more stuff, it'll still maintain that state.
I see.
Yeah.
So the prediction is conditioned on the history.
Yes. Yes.
By the way, we're out of this room in 15 minutes.
Oh, I see. I think I'll speed through this. Yeah. What was that?
Sorry, I'm missing something. What do you mean by look similar?
What do I mean by Oh yeah. So the argument I see a lot is this idea that LSTMs are very similar to, like, the update step is very similar to these sort of, like, the idea of applying gradient descent is very similar to applying a recurrent neural network. You just apply, you're performing backprop through time. That's like the shared dynamic, and so a lot of the times the argument is that they look similar, they're very similar, so let's use the exact same sort of setup. And maybe there's some sort of, you know, something great will happen. But in general, what I've seen is that the feedforward neural networks have done much better in the last sort of 3 years. And yeah, I can, still to this day, not many people use feedforward neural networks, but like I've read a lot of PhD theses, I read a lot of master's theses, I read a lot of, you know, all the papers that come out in this field, and like the feedforward neural networks have actually done much better. I guess in recent approaches, how do we train these optimizers? So there's, you know, symbolic search, RL evolution strategies, and of course the sort of backprop through time, which is sort of the original meta learning algorithm for training learned optimizers. And I guess some current problems with learned optimizers is that one is the RAM usage is pretty high because we're sort of backpropagating through an entire optimization trajectory. We're computing the Hessian over that trajectory. There's some approximations to this, but it's still, you know, pretty computationally expensive. Like sometimes when I train this, I use like terabytes of RAM, at least it's my early experiments. So it's not, you know, very cheap. And generally they've, you know, found they couldn't solve problems outside the problem domain, compared to other meta learning methods. Again, transfer efficiency is pretty low due to the components wise assumption. There's no notion of interparameter correlations. And I guess there's this phenomenon of chaotic behavior, where early noise can drastically affect later iterations of the training cycle. The researcher at UC Berkeley who created the RL scheme says that this is related to this phenomenon that a supervised learning algorithm or MLP that is parameterizing our learned optimizer has this IID assumption, and we're assuming sort of these correlated inputs, and so he's saying that this is the reason why we're experiencing some of this behavior. And I guess there's this phenomenon of short horizon bias. So you typically what happens is that people use truncated backcrop through time, so they can't. Ideally, we could backcrop through them like a million steps. We can run the optimizer for a very long time, and then we could learn an optimizer and then transfer it. But typically, they chop it off at like 10 steps. And even if we did train it for a very long time, there's still this phenomenon of exploding gradients or vanishing gradients that we see through general backcrop through time steps. And let's see, a recent approach, I guess, by DeepMind was to train on small prototypical problems. So I guess the idea of this paper was to learn a general purpose optimizer. So what they did was they trained it on a lot of general optimization problems like parabolas and stuff like this. It turned out to work not as bad as I thought it would be. These are just like parabolas and like really, academic, functions that you learn in school. So those are the input problems. And then they tested on stuff like ImageNet and like all these different, all the crazy optimization problems. And it was actually pretty impressive. It beat some of the best algorithms. So they do stuff like hierarchical RNNs as well. And again, they do really, really well in ImageNet, but it doesn't work well in terms of wall clock time. And I guess that's another thing with learned optimizers is that because the neural network is like an equation of like a thousand or a million, sub-equations, whereas, Atom is only like five equations, right? So you need to take that into consideration. There's massive overhead when you use something like a learned optimizer, or even any sort of meta learning framework. Like you have this massive overhead by parameterizing this object. Okay, so now we'll talk about this idea of variational circuits. This is the last thing I have to talk about. This is sort of pretty simple. Now that we understand this notion of a learnable optimizer, that we compute the metagradients through, and we just keep on running the metagradients until we converge on some system. There's this recent trend of learning the classical loop in QAOA. And so this can be just learned through a learned optimizer. And this is done in a few papers actually, because this is just a standard optimization problem. We can backprop through a simulator and learn the parameters of our meta parameters. I guess you guys are all probably familiar with Guillaume Verdun, who is a guy from Waterloo, and. I thought it was pretty cool that 3 months before that paper came out, there's this guy, I think it's Spain, who wrote a paper used RL for this problem. I don't even know how I ran into this. I was just reading like different papers, and I thought it was really cool because he uses RL for the classical optimization step. He replaces classical optimization with an RL agent, which is meta learning through RL, learned optimizers through RL. And he tests his approach on the Max Koch problem. I guess that's basically the general gist of it. Like he just replaces that classical loop with an RL agent and explores the QAOA space. I guess before this, there was also this well-known work by Microsoft that they patented on just learning a learning rate schedule for QAOA, like an annealing schedule. They also patented that, so I thought that was pretty cool. Some domain-specific motivations for using learned optimizers in QAOA, that there's a phenomenon of barren plateaus where there's sort of there's no gradient where the number of qubits gets larger. So the gradients become less informative. In certain regions. So hopefully we can have a learned optimizer that can navigate automatically through that sort of characteristic of the loss landscape. That's interesting because it's also a domain-specific characteristic. So that sort of motivates the use of domain-specific devices. Um, And there's this phenomenon of noisy measurements in variational circuits. So we could also have a learned optimizer that learns to deal with those noisy measurements. And I guess I talked about this paper before, which is just learned optimizers to make models robust to input noise. And they talk about various types of input noises that they make the learned optimizer robust to. And then all they do is they just put that in the meta loss, and they train the behavior of the optimizer accordingly. And also in the DeepMind paper that I mentioned earlier, where they use prototypical loss landscapes, they also sort of purposely expose the optimizer to noisy problems such that it can learn to be robust to them. I think is interesting way to solve this. If we properly train a learned optimizer, we just plug it into the system, it'll automatically learn to deal with these domain-specific issues with the loss with the problem domain, which is very cool because it's sort of a drop-in replacement to your regular system. The general setup, if anyone's not familiar with sort of QAOA, is that we just want to learn the gamma and beta parameters to minimize the expectation of a variational circuit. And so we just want to learn this parameter vector, and then the beta and gamma parameters to apply to the variational circuit, and then we measure the expectation of the variational circuit, and can also compute the gradient of the parameter vector with respect to the expectation, and it gives us a few methods for doing this, which is like the parameter shift rule. And this gradient can be fed to a learned optimizer or a regular optimizer. There's two papers that that we're gonna quickly discuss. One is this phenomenon of learning an initialization for a variational circuit, so a starting point for a variational circuit, and then what we're gonna do is once you have this good initialization, you're gonna apply a regular optimizer, and it'll find the beta and gamma parameters accordingly. So the idea is that you learn a learned optimizer that learns to position the QAOA system into a good basin of attraction, and then you just optimize it with a very normal optimizer. And then there's another paper that came up, I think, at NASA a few months after. It was this phenomenon of learning, there's no phenomenon of learning it's no initialization, it's just you learn a standalone optimizer without the initialization. These two papers, I think, are very critical in the study of variational circuits, at least the intersection of variational circuits and meta learning. So I'm gonna comment on both of them. I think both are very interesting, both have interesting innovations. So this is the Wilson paper. So he has a neural optimizer parameterized by an LSTM, so very classic. And I guess the motivation was that because DeepMind used the exact same setup. And I guess it's a motivation by a lot of these papers that DeepMind used it, so let's use a similar setup. And then the LSTM takes a gradient as input, so the gradient of the expectation of the variational circuit. So that's interesting. Verdon's paper does not do this. Another thing that's very interesting is that they use this preprocessing scheme that DeepMind proposed. There's a few different preprocessing schemes for learned optimizers that were proposed in the past few years. They use the original scheme. And so this is not a computationally efficient scheme, so I was surprised that they use this, because it essentially augments the parameter size of the learned optimizer by two. So I think it's probably because DeepMind used it, so let's use it too. Meta loss is the weighted sum of the losses of the base optimization, as a typo. Essentially the sum of the entire loss trajectory instead of the last loss, as we saw before. The weights are hyperparameters, but in practice, they said they actually didn't tune these. So they just said, set them to one. And they reported performance in iterations. The meta learner does pretty well except on one. Maybe they should report wall clock time. That's usually a great metric in learned optimizers. They didn't report it because that doesn't account for the overhead of the neural optimizer. I guess they also said they only ran it on simulations. They didn't run it on real hardware. So it was, whereas Verdon actually ran it on real hardware. They trained the optimizer on simulations and then they ran it on real hardware. At least to my understanding, that's what they did. And so, yeah, they reported pretty good results, I think, on all.
Like 2 minutes.
Oh, I see. Yeah, reported good results on all, basically all problems, zip one. And let's see. So yeah, this the Verdon paper, what they did is that the general idea is that they have a learned optimizer, they run it only for 10 steps, and then they apply a normal optimizer. So yeah, so what happens is that the learned optimizer does pretty well because it brings you to this really nice area that has a good vicinity of high quality open local alpha. And then you apply a normal optimization algorithm. That's basically the idea. And so they do not take the gradients as inputs. They just take the previous expectation value and the last parameter values. And they transfer from small problems, they have input problems from the simulator to real world problems on hardware, which is fascinating. And I guess another innovation that I've never seen before in the meta learning literature was that they have this loss function that for rewarding optimizers which make improvements to the last seen lowest loss. And again, they only run it for 10 steps and they, you know, run a normal optimizer. And so yeah, here's they have this very simple loss function, a meta loss function. So they just wanna constantly make improvements to the last best seen lowest loss. So they keep on trying to improve that lowest loss that they've seen during this optimization trajectory. So it's sort of rewarding almost monotonic behavior somewhat. Yeah, this just worked well on all problems, I think. I think so. And I guess just some notes on launching a spinoff from academia, like we're starting a spinoff from Mila. I'll just go through this one. This concept, like what I find is like a lot of startup founders don't know this concept of that Warren Buffett proposed. Economic modes. A lot of business people do, but not tech people. And so for algorithm-based companies, what you want to think about is, this is essentially a way of analyzing how successful your company will be. And it's actually a concrete framework. Like if you want to start a company, you need to think of these things. And what I thought was great about this framework, it wasn't this business nonsense. It was an actual framework for building successful companies. So if you're interested in learning more about this, I would recommend reading into Morningstar, like some of their philosophy. It's a hedge fund. They have like books on this topic. They've expanded on Warren Buffett's original framework, and they've done so much on that work. So network effects, the issue with machine learning companies is that these network effects are logarithmic, so you need to think of the coefficients of that network effect. Trade secrets, like Google's algorithm is very strong. Brand is very also important. So you need to think of the brand coefficient when your company. So Stripe has a strong brand. Qualcomm is also very interesting in terms of patents, right? So they're very aggressive on their patents. Like they have these patents on like the cell phone chips, and they charge a royalty on the like companies like Apple just for these like very cheap chips because they own the patents on them. There's also this phenomenon of a vendor lock-in. I love Oracle for doing this properly because it's funny because AWS or Amazon was using Oracle for 20 years, right? They didn't even use AWS, their own service, because they're locked into Oracle. And this phenomenon of vendor lock-in is just like you're stuck on a platform and you can't move. So Oracle sort of executed that pretty well. Like you're stuck on a database. You're basically, if you use it for a few years, like it's going to be really tough to move off that database. So it's just pretty funny how Amazon was on that for a long time. And scale effects, sort of like Walmart or AWS, where you can buy so much in bulk, and then you could pass on some of the savings to your end customer. So these are all very concrete things that Warren Buffett proposed for analyzing the success of a company. And so you can, instead of like know all this business stuff, these are very tractable, in my opinion, stuff you can think about. And I recommend reading into Morningstar and their philosophy if you're interested in startups. And just generally a heuristic by most venture capitalists is that your company valuation is usually something like 10x times revenue. So I guess sometimes when I see founders, they talk about this phenomenon of, so the idea of an economic mode is that you're protected, right? Like even if a new entrant comes into your space, like you'll still be successful. And so I see a lot of founders, they say like, I have this algorithm that runs, X faster. Like we're running restricted Boltzmann machines on this problem and we're gonna succeed. So usually that's not sufficient. Like a new entrant will come and like it's sort of game over for you. So you need to think of all these dimensions when you're building a company. Yeah, I was talking, there's this conversation with this guy who runs an investment firm. He just talks about, you know, just like this phenomenon of a product quality not being enough. So like an algorithm that just 10x better alone is not enough. You need complements to that. So we're talking about this stuff, and actually this is a conversation with me, so you can find this online on his website. So you can go on his blog and you can see him. And I guess some other stuff, this phenomenon of I see a lot of founders who over-optimize on different stuff of their company. I think it's a fundamentally like a sort of a thing with imposter syndrome. It's not really because they really, you know, are fascinated with the technology. So I'd recommend, I still see people like, you know, who could use like two lines of scikit-learn, but they read these like esoteric like ML papers. And I'm just like, you know, that's not, you could save a lot of time instead of, you know, doing stuff like this. And that's basically it. Any questions?
So I don't see anyone beating down the door, but I'm gonna formally dissolve this meeting here. And we can take questions up here until somebody tries to come in, or we can go downstairs to the bistro. Okay, let's thank Matt again.